Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 10th of March 2023 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshank, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode 68 of Patriotic History and we're concentrating on British history at the moment. Right at the beginning of the series we looked at history in the Fertile Crescent and Egypt, so we're not really limiting ourselves just to Europe here, but at the moment we're concentrating on Britain. We started out the series with the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community and probably about a dozen or so episodes back, Truthvids from truthvids.net joined us. And at the moment, we're concentrating on this most excellent Welsh king, Hywel Da, or Hywel the Good. So, Truthvids, how are you doing? Welcome back to the show. How's life treating you?
All good, Sven. Great to be back, as always.
Excellent, excellent. How are you doing, Patriarch? How is life treating you?
Very well, Sven. Ready to start the week and learn some more British history.
Excellent stuff. And we're concentrating on the laws at the moment, which I think really give us an idea, not just of the laws that the Welsh had, although there are some bits that were different from the Saxons, but it points those out. But I think these are the sort of laws that the Saxons had as well, most of the people in Britain had, because they'd grown over time. And in the last episode we were looking at nationality, and you had to have been well behaved for 10 generations before you could become naturalized as a Briton. And today we're going to start out looking at women. The position of women under Welsh law differed significantly to that of their Norman English contemporaries. A marriage could be established in two basic ways. The normal way was that the woman would be given to a man by her kindred, and the abnormal way was that the woman could elope with a man without the consent of her kindred. In this case, her kindred could compel her to return if she was still a virgin. But if she was not, she could not be compelled to return. If the relationship lasted for 7 years, she had the same entitlements as if she had been given by her kin. And this is interesting, because the actual marriage itself is the Marriage Act, and that's what the marriage is in a Bible. It's the consummation of the marriage is what actually makes a person married or not. It's not the ring that's exchanged, it's not signing in a book or anything like that. It's the actual consummation of the marriage, and that's why it's saying here that if she was still a virgin, she could be compelled to come back, and that's because she wouldn't be married. But if the marriage had been consummated and she was not still a virgin, then she could not be compelled to return, because who was going to marry somebody that was married to somebody else? They would be committing adultery then. That's what the point of this was. And the reason, because this has got changed today, and we think that a marriage is not the Marriage Act, it's the marriage ceremony, that's how they were able to change things and come up with the concept of gay marriage. If marriage still had the original meaning of the consummation of the marriage, they would not have been able to get away with changing the definition to gay marriage, I think. It's only because it changed in people's minds to being associated with the ceremony that they were able to do it, because then they could say, oh, well, two men could have that ceremony, therefore two men are married. Whereas the actual real meaning of it, it's not possible for two men to get married. And that's the biblical meaning of it. And as we can see here, that it was that's what a marriage was at this point, which is around about 950 AD. So 1100 years ago. I'm terrible at maths. Over 1,000 years ago, anyway, we had this understanding back then that a marriage was actually consummation of the marriage. Any thoughts on this, Truthvids?
Yeah, I was just going to say the whole concept of, the woman's role in society was very different back then. Women needed a guardian, i.e. their father. And if you wanted to marry that woman, you couldn't just take her out on a date and put on a personality and seduce her. You had to go to the father, and he would vet you to see that, you're not a wrong'un, and he would find out about, your family, your history, your ancestry. And only he could approve and say, okay, I give you permission to marry my daughter. And if not, it would be an elder brother or an uncle, because people understood that women could be seduced, right? And that's all, that's all goes back to Genesis in the Bible, where Eve is seduced, because really she needed Adam to, you know, protect him. And that's also the relationship with God and the children of Israel, right? He's the husband and they're the wife. And the Israelites always get seduced by paganism and all the, you know, foreign customs, and they've always got to stay with God. And today we have the opposite. We deliberately have this independent woman thing where they're encouraged to go their own way, to go find a man themselves, to, you know, basically have careers and that, so that really it's just a deception so that they won't have children. So really it's just an anti-white thing to reduce our population. But that's why we have all that. And we see in the ancient world, they didn't have that men had to, you had to go to the, you know, guardian, and that's how you would get a wife. And that was the normal thing, not just here, but all across Europe and the white world, right?
Yeah, and it makes sense, really, because it means, as you pointed out at the beginning there, that the suitor is not going to be able to get one over on the bride, you know, or the future bride may be blinded by love, blinded by lust, but the father certainly isn't going to be. I know that the Romans looked down on marrying for love or marrying for lust. They looked down upon that. And arranged marriage was the thing that went on. That was the accepted, that was just the accepted way that things were. And it continued in that way in India. And I think right up until 10, 15 years ago, they just had no divorces at all in India, where they still had all these arranged marriages. And I saw a BBC program where they interviewed these people that had been on these arranged marriages, and they weren't able to find anybody over the age of 40 that was going to run them down. And they looked the happiest people that I had ever seen. And they managed to find a couple that were in their 20s that said, well, things haven't been so good, but it effectively said that if they stuck with it, it would be absolutely perfect. And once they had the children, and they would grow to fall in love rather than falling in love and getting married. With an arranged marriage, you get married, and then you fall in love after you're married. It's a completely different way to the way that we do it today. And I think that was more like what it was like in Roman times, and possibly here, as I say, around about 950 AD. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I guess it goes to show the extent to how much the organized churches had over time, really. And it was a power play by them, wasn't it? I mean, to take the essence of marriage and claim that is the, you know, that they, what was the saying, they, by the power invested me, I now pronounce you man and wife, is that that's what the priest says. So they took that power, you know, as something very fundamentally natural, ordained by God, and totally put it in the hands of this kind of, artificial priesthood that sanctified marriage, and that was how it was done. So, yeah, I mean, they must have accrued a lot of power through that, and perhaps a lot of wealth as well came from it. It's a shame that a lot of these principles we've spoken of are kind of still practiced by, you know, Muslims, just because they're probably more associated with Islam or Eastern faiths, where a lot of the traditions probably remained and hadn't been so perverted as much from, you know, the kind of westernized sentiments as well.
Yeah, I think in places like Pakistan, I think possibly in Albania, if a maiden can be captured by a male and he has sex with her, that's it. She's married to him, because nobody else is going to want to marry them. In Pakistan, they have a problem with this, with Muslims doing it to Christian girls. And the Christian girl is then forced to be married to the Muslim. And we would look at that today and we say, oh, how barbaric that is. But if you were to go back years ago, once somebody had lost their virginity, nobody would want to marry them. There was no state that was going to provide for them. They needed to have somebody that was going to provide for them and pay for them and bring up the child, as it were. So the person that kidnapped them, effectively, they would have to do that. And if that happened to a woman, again, she'd be looked down upon for allowing that to happen, for not staying within the area where she was safe, and going out somewhere where she could be picked up by a man. And that attitude, partly that attitude, we still see with people that come from other countries, but particularly parts of Africa that come to Britain, and they see the women walking about without a man, and they think that they're unattached, and they're looking for a man. They're looking for somebody to have sex with them and be married to them. In fact, they'll look at schoolgirls like that, because they have such a different culture to the culture that we have today. Well, a number of payments are connected with marriage. A MOBA, or commutation fee, was a fee payable to the woman's lord on the loss of her virginity, whether on marriage or otherwise. And that's put in there by Wikipedia. I would say, well, that is marriage, obviously. And that's basically a marriage tax, isn't it? On the loss of her virginity, it was a marriage tax. Coel, or maiden fee, was a payment due to the woman from her husband on the morning after the marriage, marking her transition from a virgin to a married woman. So again, we see here, that's what the marriage was. It was the loot. It was the taking of the virginity. It was the consummation of the marriage. That's why it's saying like the morning after the marriage, and that marked her transition from virgin to married woman. Agwedi was the amount of the common pool of property owned by the couple, which was due to the woman if the couple separated before the end of 7 years. The total of the Agwedi depended on the woman's status by birth, regardless of the actual size of the common pool of property. If the marriage broke up after the end of 7 years, the woman was entitled to half the common pool. The portion that was immediately accessible during the marriage, usually consisting of linens, dishes, and other domestic items, was known as the argivrau. And this, you could split up after 7 years. I think the Roman Church weren't very happy about this, because they assumed that it was something like a trial marriage, that they could split up after 7 years. And this was a cause of contention between them. Anyone, do you want to add to this, Trufids? Do you want to make any comments on this, or should I move on into the next section?
Yeah, generally, if it was an arranged marriage, then they should never really break up, right? Because the husband would have to have won over the father, right? And to convince him that he's going to look after this woman, that, you know, he definitely wants her. And that the father would know that he has the capability, you know, he's established that he can actually look after her and is capable of raising kids. If not, he could say, look, you know, you're too young. You know, you don't have a farm or a house. How are you going to provide for her? Come back in 10 years and take a younger daughter instead, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. So usually divorce was very rare. So this is just, in my eyes, just in case. It's just saying, you know, in the odd time that there was a divorce, this was the law that they had, just in case, right?
And it also seems as if, because the woman would get all the property if you split up before 7 years, I mean, that sort of encourages the man to behave himself, doesn't it? Because if he doesn't behave himself and they split up, the woman takes all the property. So it encourages the male to behave himself there as well, I think. Patriarch, any thoughts on this? I guess it's a dowry, isn't it? It's a dowry system.
Yeah, like you say, it's some form of tax. And, you know, it's a claim to the woman and the potential that comes through the woman, I guess. And yeah, if the marriage didn't work out, I guess the woman is made available again. But I wonder, though, would that tax still remain? Probably not. And I guess that would maybe pave way for sort of less wealthy men to probably get a look in at high caliber women.
Yeah, I guess the tax wouldn't have to be paid again, because it says it's from being a virgin to a married woman. It also implies that all the maidens were the property of the lord of the manor until they were married. And I guess people could misinterpret that and think like, oh, it's like his harem or something like that. But it's not. I mean, he was responsible for them, wasn't he? He was responsible for protecting them. Their families were responsible for protecting them. Their fathers and their brothers were responsible. But in a greater sense, the lord of the manor was also responsible for protecting them. The same as the state is responsible for protecting us today. where if a woman found her husband with another woman, she was entitled to a payment of 6 score pence, half a pound the first time, and a pound the second time, and on the third occasion she was entitled to divorce him. If the husband had a concubine, the wife was allowed to strike her without having to pay any compensation, even if it resulted in the concubine's death. A woman could only be beaten by her husband for 3 things, for giving away something which she was not entitled to give away, for being found with another man, or for wishing a blemish on her husband's beard. If he beat her for any other cause, she was entitled to the payment of sahad. If the husband found her with another man and beat her, he was not entitled to any further compensation. According to the law, women were not allowed to inherit land. However, there were exceptions even at an early date. A poem dated to the first half of the 11th century is an elegy for Adon, a landowner on Anglesey. And the poet says that after his death, his estate was inherited by 4 women who had originally been brought to Adon's court as captives after a raid and had found favour with him. The rule for the division of movable property when one of a married couple died was the same for both sexes. The property was divided into 2 equal halves, with the surviving partner keeping 1 half and the dying partner being free to give bequests from the other half. So interesting system here. So cheating wasn't did not mean you could automatically divorce. You had to catch them twice before you could divorce. And the wife was allowed to strike the concubine without any compensation. I wonder how many times she was allowed to strike the concubine, even if it resulted in the concubine's death. Was the concubine allowed to fight back? I guess what it's saying here, she was allowed to strike the concubine. So if the concubine did fight back, then the concubine would have to pay a fine. I guess that's what that's saying here, if it's saying the wife was allowed to strike her, because the concubine is obviously going to fight back, isn't she? But if she did, she would then be fined, I think. I think that's what it's saying here. And this blemish on her husband's beard, I guess that's effectively wishing ill upon your husband, wishing evil upon your husband, isn't it? That's what that would be. Truefids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, that... ill on the beard, it might be like an idiom, as you said, meaning wishing bad things on a husband. So it might have a wider context, right? It says that women, I think, could never commit adultery. You know, it was serious, but it seems it was a little bit lax on the men, even though the woman was entitled to a payment. And that may seem unfair, but that was always just how it generally was, right? As for this Aidan guy, it seems like he didn't have any heirs, so that's why he left the property to these 4 women. I don't think it was common at all. It's only if there's no men to leave it to that then they're allowed to leave it to women. And I think we brought this up in an earlier episode, right, that generally you'd want to leave all your inheritance to the men only, because the more wealth and property they have, the greater chance they have of getting a more nobler women, right? Because it really does make a difference if a man has, you know, land and that, then he can go to a father somewhere and say, look, I've got a land, I'm established, let me marry your daughter. And he'll go, yeah, okay. Whilst with a daughter, you don't really want that, because all the men from around will want to marry her just simply for the land. And you want them to marry her because they want her just as a wife and to provide for her. So you want it the other way around. You want men coming who are established rather than gold seekers who are just looking for the woman just for the land, basically, right?
I think they also tried to find people that had a similar amount of wealth as the family itself, so that there wasn't going to be any losing in status or what have you, and things were even, and that way you kept the caste system as well, I think. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Not too many, really. I wonder why it was had to be caught twice. Maybe it wasn't necessarily being caught in the act, but it was being caught with another man. And obviously, if she was caught alone with another man again, then that might suggest or it might give more of an insight into her, you know, her, you know, her, her intentions, should I say. So I'm not sure if it is it in the actual act twice, because that doesn't make so much sense to me. But I think the woman was supposed to be, wasn't allowed to be alone with another man at all, right?
Yeah, it's just if the husband was caught with another woman, then the wife was entitled to six score pence the first time. If caught a second time, then she was entitled to £1, and on the third occasion she was entitled to divorce him. But if the husband found the wife with a man and he beat her, the man wasn't entitled to any compensation. So effectively he could beat her for that term. But if he beat her for any other cause, she was entitled to some payment. So basically he wouldn't get any compensation from that. I should imagine he would be allowed to divorce her. I mean, it doesn't say here, because effectively if she was caught with another man, there was no, oh, you can get caught with a man twice and the third time he can divorce you. If the husband found her with another man, he could beat her. So that's not saying, doesn't necessarily saying found her sleeping with another man, but just found her with another man. Yeah, then he could beat her, but he wasn't entitled to any compensation if he did that. Moving into criminal law, murder was regarded as an offence against the family rather than being against society or the state. It was normally dealt with by the payment of blood money by the killer and his extended family to the family of the deceased. The base sum was computed by the social status and the position of the victim. The galanas of the King of Dehubarth was set at an impossibly long line of impossibly perfect cattle to ensure that it could never be met, while the family of a murdered slave, meanwhile, received no galanas, although the slave's owner was to be compensated for the loss. This sum might then be modified in certain situations. For an example, an attack from an ambush doubled the base fine. Upon the payment of the blood money, the victim's family was then legally bound to forego its vengeance. A murder by poison, however, carried the death penalty. And we still have this system in some Muslim countries, don't we? And you get this vendetta, you get this vengeance thing. I think they still have that in Albania. They still have a problem with this, with these blood feuds. And I think it's in Iran as well, you know, if something like this happens, or in any Muslim country that runs along with Sharia law, it's the family of the victim itself that determines whether there is a physical punishment or whether a fine is going to be paid. And I guess that the physical punishment is now carried out by the state. But years ago, if something like this happened, then you had the right to kill the killer. If you saw him, it was blood for blood, basically. And I think there's an instance in the old Israelite law codes that they had to have a city for people that this had happened to, so they could stay within this city, because if they were caught out, then they could be murdered. Perhaps Truefids knows what I'm referring to there. Or you've got any other comments on this law about murder here, Truefids?
Yeah, well, Sharia law was partly based on the Bible, right? The it was basically copied and formed, partially from the Bible. So it's quite similar. But yeah, as you said, firstly, there wasn't this great government where the government ruled over us. That's completely new. Back then, there was just people and families and clans and towns. So it was very different, and that's why they had this blood money, just because you didn't want, constant. If there was an accident or death, well, then that clan will want vengeance, and then they'll want vengeance back, and you end up with this nonstop, blood feuds. So that's, the general reason why they had that, to keep peace. There was general laws. If it was an accident, in the Bible, then that person could flee to a city, but you'd have to stay in the city forever. That they were Levite cities, right? And as long as you stayed in the city, no one could enter and kill you. But if you ever left, then the opposing family could come and kill you, right? And they would not be you know, held under the law for murder because they're simply avenging. There was actually a law in the Bible. If someone is killed and you are the relative, then you are commanded by God to seek vengeance. And even the that went on into the Greeks as well, that there's epic poets which describe that someone's brother or mother was or father was killed and they were bound to find vengeance. It was just considered the thing that you couldn't just let a brother die and just not do anything about it if it was your relative, right?
Yeah, it says that their blood will be upon their heads if they don't do that. It means that the murder will be upon their heads, and particularly on the state as well that is supposed to pay blood for blood. If there isn't a death penalty, then those deaths that occur within that state are the response of the people that are running the state. I mean, that's what it's saying, blood for blood, and his blood will be upon him. If they didn't avenge that, then the blood will be upon them. So I guess this institution of fines and money for this is one of the things that came about through the advent of Christianity, as we saw with Alfred the Great and the mercy that was a part of Christ's mission. The mercy was interpreted that instead of having these blood feuds, there would be a fine that was payable for it, and that was considered to be acceptable. So that was the bit with the cities there as well. It was if it was manslaughter, and they had to go and stay in the city. I mean, it's a very sensible law. All of those political laws in the Old Testament are fantastic. I mean, it's just basically setting out the laws that you need to have for a functioning society, for a society that functions for the common good. You know, there's a lot of common sense behind all of them. Any thoughts on these laws on murder here, Patriarch?
Well, it gives an insight into how they self-governed. And like Truthford said, there was less emphasis on an actual centralized government. Obviously, there was the overarching king that enforced the common law. But generally, it was they were their own kind of governors, weren't there? And they would have had to follow the law themselves and really, believe in it. I guess it was heavily rooted in biblical principles. So most of the people must have, been of faith, I think, because they kind of go hand in hand, don't they? So I think, that would have been a good way to maintain kind of the religion and what through the law system and justice.
And people would be obey these laws as well. And if they didn't, that was when you went to the court to say that somebody has disobeyed this law, hasn't paid the proper fine. And then you would have, as we talked about in the last episode, then you'd have to get a certain number of people to back you up and say, well, yeah, this person isn't going to lie. He's an honourable person. And offences against honour or common assault were also dealt with in a similar fashion through a fine called sahade. However, that one only applied to the upper classes. Any serf who struck a free man was liable to have the offending limb removed. So you can see that they're very important, the status here, and the status meant a lot. So if a serf struck a free man, he was liable to having the offending limb removed. But if a free man struck a free man, there was a fine. The crime of rape was treated as a theft and remedied by the payment of another fine, derui, which sounds very close to dowry, payment of which restored the woman's virginity for legal purposes. A man who could not pay the fine was to have his testicles removed. So this is an interesting one. Because in the Israelite one, I mean, if somebody's raped, then they have to be taken by the person that raped them. And that's the way that the law is in Islam. So they had a separate thing here. Well, I should imagine the payment of a fine restored the woman's virginity for legal purposes. I'm surprised at that. I would have thought there would be a payment of a marriage tax rather than saying the woman was legally a virgin again, because nobody would want to marry somebody who had already been taken by another man. So I'm very surprised at this one. And then if a man did not pay the fine, he would have his testicles removed. Ah, interesting. I wasn't expecting that. Truthfords, any thoughts on this? The assaults against honour and the crime of rape?
Well, in the Bible, you couldn't just take another Israelite woman without the approval of the father, right? If you just took her and basically raped her, then the father could demand her back and a fine. So this does actually come from the Bible. But anyone outside the kingdom, that there was no law, right? If you went and took an Egyptian woman, you know, who are still white back then there's no one, no Israelite's going to be able to demand, oh, no, you have to give her back because there's no Israelite father, right? So there was a law against you being able to just take, you know, a father's daughter. You always had to get the approval, and he could demand her back and even demand a payment. You can read that in, I believe, Leviticus or Deuteronomy. So it is biblical.
Wow. I thought the biblical one must have been like the Islamic one. Interesting. Patriarch, any thoughts here?
Just on the whole notion of restoring a woman's virginity, I think, like you say, it's a little bit odd that because I don't believe it can be restored, can it? Even by the notion of, I mean, but in the past, they knew that the woman was still a virgin by the some skin or something, or a seal that, you know, if she bled, that would have been the breaking of the seal, and that would suggest that she was still a virgin. So, I don't think, you know, virginity could be given back at all. But yeah, it was probably just for that, for to sustain their legal cohesion.
It was probably to help force the man to pay this, because if he didn't pay the fine, he was going to have his testicles removed. But I can't see that anybody would then want to marry somebody that had already been taken by another man, which they would know. So restoring the woman's virginity for legal purposes, and perhaps if a woman was a maiden, there were certain legal entitlements that she had if she was still a maiden. That's one I think that we'd have to do some more research on.
Only the Levites had to marry a virgin, you know, because they were meant to be the true example of, you know, what a good man had, you know, should live. But other Israelites, they could technically take women who had been married before, but the Levites were not allowed to, because they were held to a higher standard.
So effectively, it meant that she was free to marry somebody else. It wasn't that as if she was accepted as she was married to the man that had raped her. She was then free after the payment of this fine. She would be free to marry someone else. I think that's what it's saying legally, isn't it? Because otherwise they could say, well, you're married to the guy that raped you. You can't marry someone else. So I think that's effectively what it's saying, isn't it? That's what it means by the league for legal purposes. That status, that the legal status is returned to her, so that she can marry someone if she does find somebody that wants to marry her, I guess. Similarly, a convicted thief was imprisoned in the first instance, but a serf convicted for the third time was to have his hand removed, assuming he was not caught in the act, that is. Thieves that were caught with goods in hand more valuable than 4 kenogel were liable for hanging. Such strong penalties led the Welsh to narrowly define theft. However, forcible robbery was considered much less serious. Further, a hungry man who had passed at least 3 towns without receiving a meal could not be punished for stealing food. And we talked a little bit about the seriousness of theft last time, didn't we? And the need to have a strong deterrent against theft, which we still have in the Islamic countries, where they cut the hands off. Aiding and abetting, including witnessing a killing and failing to protect the victim or receiving stolen property, was also punished with fines. Although Howell's commission generally recorded the traditions of the country, one modification they made was to end the right of nobles to trial by combat, finding it to be unjust. That's a shame. I think right of combat was quite a noble one, really. I thought that went on until the 18th century. But Howell does laws actually did away with that. So we've got a few here. We've got robbery, aiding or abetting, stolen property. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz?
Yeah, I think we still had that in the law, but everybody just ignored it. And then I can't remember, was it a politician or something 200 years ago? He was caught, you know, and he was going to go to prison. And he said, oh, no, I found in the law, I demand the trial by combat. And everybody was so flabbergasted that they said, what? What are you doing? And then they saw that technically it was still in the law. So then they removed it and he got off. But from then on, no, you can't do that anymore. But I think, I'm not sure that in the trial by combat, you might have been able to choose a champion for you. I'm not sure about that. But, you know, if you had like an invincible champion, you could basically just always win, right? He would be undefeated and you could get away with everything. So, or even if you yourself were just a great warrior, you know, you could rape, you know, women and then just demand trial by combat and there's nothing they could do. So obviously, they had to do away with that one. I understand, right? And sorry, something you said earlier about murder, that you could run away but not poison. It shows you that people hated treachery, that, you know, because poison was seen as treachery. I meant to say that. And it just wasn't part of our culture, the whole poisoning thing. We've always just despised that, right, in a white Western civilization.
Yeah, very underhand. I think poisoning sort of went on with Vortigern, didn't it? Or didn't one of the Saxons poison them, or his wife poisoned them? Something to do with Vortigern and Vortimer. There was a poisoning incident there. Petra, any thoughts on these laws here?
Obviously, there was obviously flawed. Some of them were showed. Some mercy to a certain extent with the hungry man who had passed at least three towns without receiving a meal could not be punished for stealing. I wonder if that was because, I mean, if he was forced to steal or felt like he needed to steal, maybe it showed that the towns in general didn't show compassion in the first place. So I don't know, maybe they kind of bypassed that for some reason. But generally, I think combat wouldn't be a good way to show justice.
Yeah, it looks like you know, that crime would be on the towns that refused to feed him. So I mean, that would look badly on the towns that he passed through. So that crime would be on their heads because they should have showed charity. And yeah, that trial by combat, I mean, it's a bit like a bully's charter, isn't it? You know, whoever's the biggest could just get away with breaking all these laws. I mean, in most cases, the larger a person is, the more meek and mild they tend to be because they don't have to use their strength so much. And, you know, the larger people tend to be the sort of people that would look out for the smaller people, in my experience, rather than, you know, the larger people being the bullying type. That doesn't very often happen. So maybe that was even more pronounced back then, and that's why we had this trial by combat up to this point. But yeah, I mean, it could be today. It would just be a bully's charter, wouldn't it? That's the thing with it. Well, medieval Welsh law placed a high value on compensation for any breach of the law. In particular, there were high and detailed compensation values that were given for each limb of the body. There are 9 limbs of equal value. That is the hands, the eyes, the lips, the feet, and the nose, each of which is valued at 480 pennies. Every other limb is carefully valued and can be altered depending upon various influencing factors. The values given to eyes, ears, nose, lips, hands, and feet are identical, and they are termed as the limbs of equal value. And they represent 12.7% of the standard Galanas for a Bonedig. And a Bonedig is a standard free man whose Galanas is valued at 3,780 pennies, which was the equivalent of 63 cows. Fingers are valued at 80 pence each, whilst a thumb has a value of 180 pence, which corresponds to its use in gripping agricultural equipment or arms. The triad, known as the three dangerous wounds of man, specifies three injuries for which he who is wounded shall have £3 from him who wounds him. These are when a man is cut so that the brains can be seen, when a man is pierced so his entrails can be seen, and when one of the four posts of the body, which are the limbs, are broken. They also had a bit where if something was damaged, like if you lost your eyesight but you could still see the eyes there, and the eyes weren't damaged but you lost your eyesight, you also got payment for that. So it wasn't just specifically that the limbs were broken or damaged if you weren't able to use them. And you can see here that it was all based on how important those limbs were for society, for gripping agricultural equipment or arms. Both of those were of equal importance. The body parts appear to be classed for compensation based on how much use they have in society. The higher the use, the higher the compensation cost. Loss of hearing, for example, as well as loss of testes and or penis, incur very high redress rates because their loss will cause either danger or an inability to continue lineage, which was highly important in such a kin-based society. The tongue is also particularly high because, as with the ear, it would have formed the primary means of communication for the victim. Also notable are the different grades of compensation given to wounds, depending on the degree of disfigurement produced by the wounding, with a differentiation between a conspicuous scar, which attracts remarks, and a hidden scar, which will therefore attract less remarks. I mean, this is very well thought out, isn't it? There's a lot more detail here that it goes into in Wikipedia about all these injuries and the compensation that you would get for them. And obviously, it would be a different amount depending on what your status was in society as well, as well as it being a different amount depending on how harmed the body was and how well you were still able to contribute to society. On top of that, there was also your status that you actually had. And I think if it was a slave that was harmed, it was the owner of the slave that was due the money. And of course, if you were a slave, that would be because you got yourself into debt, basically, more than anything else. So the person was responsible for you, and it would be for a certain amount of time. I think these are, you know, it shows quite how civilized they were, that they had developed this. Treefids, any thoughts on these fines here for injury?
Well, yeah, if you were like injured and, you know, like just you lost a finger or a hand or, you know, an eye, it really would hinder you in being able to work and establish yourself, build, feed yourself and your family. So it was really serious. They didn't just have like a benefit system where you just go to the government and, you know, it's okay, that they'll look after you, or you know, all these cushy jobs that we have where you can just go get an office job or, you know, some kind of council job where you just sit in an office and you can still earn a high salary. You know, there was none of that. Everybody had to work the land or you'd, you know, have to hold a sword and fight and defend yourself. So obviously that's why it was taken so seriously. And I imagine if the person couldn't pay, then they would have to have eye for an eye, right? They would have to lose the same, whatever they took of you, like your hand or your arm, they would have to lose it as well if they couldn't pay, I imagine, right?
Or hock themselves into slavery to somebody to get the fine, to avoid, you know, the having part of your body cut off. They could put themselves into indentured servitude for 8 years for a certain amount of money in order to pay the fine. So that would be another way of doing it. You can see here how important the thumb is, that we have these opposable thumbs. Thumbs are valued at over double the amount of a finger because it's so important that we have a thumb that we're able to grip things. Pajar, any thoughts on this compensation scheme?
Yeah, I think it relies heavily on social shaming, doesn't it? In a way to, you know, kind of keep everyone in check, you know. Things are very much rooted in shame and that would affect how you're perceived in society and how functional you were in society. So it was a system whereby everyone was kind of correcting each other. It was all sort of self-corrective in a way, and it's the opposite of what we have now, where we're not even allowed to shame people, you know, in fear of offending. And that goes to show the extent of the power structure has today, like authority and law enforcement is solely in their hands, like, and the people have no power whatsoever, not even the power to correct or shame each other.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it was in the hands of the people, and it was accepted that this is what would happen. You'd have to pay the fine, or there'd be like a blood feud. And it was the people that sought justice and achieved justice. And if somebody didn't pay up, then they would go to the court. But there wasn't a police force to enforce these things. I don't think they had Shire Reeves by this time either. So it was up to the people to enforce these laws, and they had developed over time, as Truthvid's pointed out, that, you know, they bear a lot of similarity to these Israelite laws. We'll have a look at sureties and contracts next. A section on surety lays down the rules. If a person acts as a mach or as a surety, for example, for a debt, and gives the provisions for various cases, such as where the debtor refuses to pay or denies the debt, and when the surety denies the suretyship or contests the sum involved. In what is thought to be an archaic survival in some versions of Yoweth, it is stated that women are not entitled to act as sureties or to give sureties. Well, I would say that's just common sense, because women can't work to pay these things. Women can't defend themselves to defend these things. And it would be uncivilized to punish a woman. So that was the reason why women weren't allowed to testify in court, or couldn't be charged with things. It was the husband that could be charged with it, because it was just so unheard of to punish a woman. I mean, you know, they're the weaker sex. It's wrong of you to punish them. So that I think was the origins of where this law came in, that women were not entitled to act as sureties. Later versions of this law, or later versions of this rule in your West, state that women were entitled to give sureties and could therefore enter into contracts, though they were still not allowed to act as sureties. So I guess they could give a surety on behalf of someone else, on behalf of a male. On the death of a landowner, his immovable estate or his land passed in joint tenancy to his sons, similar to the Gavelkin system of Kent. Then the youngest son partitioned the land equally, and each brother took his share. Illegitimate sons were entitled to shares equal to those of legitimate sons, provided they had been acknowledged by the father. And this provision differed the most from canon law. As the Yoweth text puts it, the law of the church says that no one is entitled to patrimony save the father's eldest son by his wedded wife. The law of Howel adjudges it to the youngest son as to the eldest, and judges that the father's sin and his illegality should not be set against the son for his patrimony. And again, I mean, it's interesting, this legitimate, illegitimate side of things, and quite what was illegitimate. If you're allowed to have more than one wife, and if you consummated the marriage, you were then married to them. So not quite sure what the illegality would be. There wasn't an instance of fornication, there was fornication, but there wasn't an instance of race mixing, which is one of the descriptions of fornication in the Old Testament. So an illegitimate son would be a son that was conceived through race mixing, but that wouldn't happen here. So I'm not quite sure what would cause a son to be illegitimate. And I think that what they're saying about here about women not acting as sureties, you know, I think that was sensible. I mean, today they say, oh, this is terrible. They, you know, women should have been equal to men. But the reason for that is because you couldn't punish a woman. So women couldn't be punished. But at the same time, they couldn't act as witnesses in court or anything like that. But the husband would be responsible for them and would be responsible for their behavior as well. The husband could be taken to court if the wife did something wrong. Any thoughts on sureties and contracts here, Truefitz?
Yeah, it was common if you had a problem with a woman, you'd always go to the husband and complain to him directly and say, your wife has done this. You wouldn't go to her. You'd always go to the husband. And the same with the children. And he was always held responsible, right? And that ensured that he would keep them in line. That was just always how it was. You know, with illegitimate sons, it's inevitable in society that you'd always get the odd man who would, you know, go around and have, you know, affairs or whatever. And then, you know, years later, a son would just appear and say, oh, I'm the son of so-and-so. And, you know, that's where they would be, well, I don't know if they're legitimate or illegitimate. And it would only be if the father acknowledged them and said, yes, it's true, I did lay with that woman and he is a son. But, you know, the father generally had the right to acknowledge that. That's how I think what it means here, right?
Yeah, Jacob Israel had four wives, didn't he? And Abraham had a wife, and he also had a concubine. And the son of the concubine, or the son of Hagar, was attributed as a son, just wasn't as important as the son of his main wife, Sarah. And as it said, I mean, that's what the law of the church was based upon, that it was just the father's eldest son by his wedded wife. That was the one that could inherit the money. And that what that would do is the other sons would then be encouraged to go off and find somewhere else, go out and conquer some other part of the world, so that they could earn something to give to their firstborn son. And one of the other sons would maybe go and join the church. So it encouraged us to spread out across the world, basically doing things like that, just giving it to the father's eldest son. And it also meant that there would be the most amount of wealth. The more wealth you have, the more you can do with it. You know, if it's all split up into small amounts, there's not very much that can be done with it. So the argument could be made that it enabled society to make more use of capital when you just had one person that inherited all of it. And what the Welsh were doing is they would just split that evenly between all the male descendants. And because of that, you know, the lands would get split up and they couldn't really provide this, you know, they didn't have a lot of strength in a lot of places, a lot of times. And I think one of the reasons why Edward I was able to go in there and conquer them is because they had all these arguments amongst all these petty princes that were all laying claim to parts of Wales. So I do think it's a better way of doing it, to give it to the eldest son. But then the eldest son could always then portion some out to the younger brothers if he wished, which would, you know, that would be an honourable thing to do. But to make sure that there was enough there so that it could still be used as capital to invest in society. I think, yeah. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I guess regarding the illegitimate sons, I mean, it doesn't state exactly what made a son illegitimate. Maybe it's not his first wife or something like that. But maybe it allowed room for error, perhaps. If I think it's heavily reliant on the father's sort of intuition and blessing, essentially, which we know how prominent or important that was in the Bible, especially with Abraham and you know, giving the blessings and passing the blessings on to the sons and so on. And, you know, maybe if the father felt like, you know, the sons that he does have won't do much with his wealth, then perhaps, you know, he took it upon himself to go elsewhere and you know, have other offspring that might be illegitimate in the eyes of the law, but perhaps maybe legitimate in terms of doing something prosperous with their inheritance.
Well, also, if he acknowledges them, as you're saying, that means he blesses them. That means he's given them their blessing. So it was based upon what the father wanted to do. And there we have succession. From the time of the fall of Rome, Wales was divided into numerous petty kingdoms or peoples, which were repeatedly unified and then redivided. It is frequently stated that Welsh law demanded the division of a kingdom between all the ruler's sons, but that is a misunderstanding of the inheritance law. The crown itself was unitary, but the king's lands were required to be divided amongst all of his acknowledged sons by whatever mother. And this naturally weakened the position of the new king. And that weakness, along with the long, free and separate traditions of the various Welsh Gwyleth, then permitted disputes and civil wars among the family appendages. And this is what it says in the history of the kings of England, that's what the problem was. The Welsh were all fighting amongst themselves, and that's why they ended up losing to the Saxons in England, because they couldn't unite together because they had all these petty arguments. And that's the sort of sad ending to the history of the kings of Britain, which sort of takes us up to around about this time, I think, or just before this time. I should remember actually the name of the last king in there, but it escapes my memory for the time being. Truefids, any thoughts on this succession here with the kings?
Yeah, well, if you think about it, if you have a king who's somehow managed to set himself up as King of Wales, and then he divides all the land between his own sons, then the previous owners of those districts are going to lose out to these new sons. And then if another one of those sons rises up and manages to gain it all, he's dividing it all amongst his sons. So all the previous sons from the previous father are all losing. So you're going to constantly get this friction over who owns what. And that's why, you know, it should just be one king. And, you know, the certain areas would simply be run by whoever he chooses, or you can have a perpetual lordship or barons, but that's the way it has to be, and he can choose who runs what for the good of the kingdom, right? If one family is just going downhill, either he can say, look, you have to retire and let your son take place because I'm disappointed with you, or I'm just going to take it away and give it to someone else. And also, as you said, if you have this constant division, you're going to get weaker and weaker, and another kingdom, even if they're not as good as you, you know, military and all that, if they're simply having a simple law where it's passed down to one all the time, they're always going to remain strong, even if they're not as great as the other opposing kingdom. And if that opposing kingdom is constantly dividing, then they're going to keep getting weaker and weaker. And as you said, that's probably how Edward I so easily just came in, because they were all divided amongst themselves, right?
Yeah, you can see equality is really not—it's not a natural system. You know, the natural system is hierarchy, with somebody at the top. And the king that I was trying to think of was Cadwalder. Cadwalder Sanctus was the last Welsh king that was a Pendragon and controlled the whole place. And then there wasn't somebody from the Welsh line again until the Tudors. But then when you think of William the Norman, he came from Normandy, and the Normans were originally the Cymry anyway. But the Saxons were originally the same as the Cymry when they were the Scythians and the Cimmerians before they split off into those two branches. So you can see it's the same people, really, just slightly different customs between them. Patriarch, any thoughts on this kingship law?
A little bit of a step back, isn't it, in terms of being united? But no, nothing too much to say on this bit. Sorry.
That's all right. Well, let's move into this administration of law. A person accused of a crime could deny the charge by denying it on oath and then finding a certain number of persons prepared to go on oath that they believed his or her own oath, a system known as compurgation. The number of persons required to swear depended on the gravity of the alleged crime. For example, denying a homicide could require 100 compurgators, while if a woman accused a man of rape, the man would have to find 50 men prepared to swear to his innocence. For lesser crimes, a smaller number would be sufficient. Witnesses could also be called, including eyewitnesses of the crime. A witness who has once been proved to have given false testimony on oath was barred from ever appearing as a witness again. And the task of the judge, having considered the case, was to determine what sort of proof was appropriate and which of the parties was to be required to produce the proof, whether by the calling of witnesses, by compurgation, or by pledges. Then, in the light of the proof, to adjudicate on the case and to impose the appropriate penalty in accordance with the law if a penalty was called for. So again, this is based on, it's so much based on the importance of community and the importance of being a part of the community, because you'd have to have all these compurgators to stand up for you. I mean, today, some of us don't even know who our neighbours are. And yet back then, and you had to be closely, you had to behave yourself, you had to behave with honour in case something happened that you got the blame for. And then you would want to be able to take an oath, and you would want people to say, he's an honourable man. He would not lie to you. And you would have to provide all these people to say that. And this is where the origins of our trial by jury comes from. Trial by 12 men and true, just and true. The 12 people that are there. This goes back to this compurgation of a number of people that would need to be there to swear that you would keep your oath and that you wouldn't lie. And obviously it says here there are other things that could also be included as well. Evidence, calling for witnesses, you know, whatever the proof would be, depending on whatever the crime was. Any thoughts on this, Truth Fitz?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when they say you would need witnesses, it's only if you were there. You know, for example, if you was alone with a woman, then at a certain point, then she could accuse you of rape, right? If you was in a different country or a different district at the time, then you can say, well, look, I wasn't there. It's impossible. So you wouldn't need witnesses. I imagine, right, from this, it was based on logic. But this also shows you that you had to be careful what you did. For example, that's why a man would never let his wife be alone with another man, right? Because something like this could happen. He could rape her and then deny it. That's why she always had to stay at home where she was protected. Or if he was going out of town, he would make sure that he had someone to protect her who would be at his house, or he would go put her with a relative until he returned, etc. And also, if you weren't from this town, you wouldn't just wander about, you know, because you could be accused of crimes. You'd be very careful and make sure you stayed somewhere where there's plenty of witnesses that can see what you're doing and that you're not doing any crimes. So that's basically how it was. You know, with these witnesses, it was only if people were caught alone and then someone could testify against them that you'd need these witnesses, right?
So it all depended on what the crime was. What the, you know, whether it would be witnesses, whether it would be evidence, whether it would be compurgators, so all sorts of factors that tie in here. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Not too much. The thing that came to mind was, I don't know, sometimes on social media you see Keanu Reeves with, if he ever has photos with women, he makes sure his hands are very visible so they can't accuse him of touching them. So that's what Truth Fitz, what he was alluding to with the men making sure they weren't seen in public. Just, I don't know, that was what came to mind. Yeah, anyway,
make sure you're not in a position where you could be accused of any of these things.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, because then don't forget, you could also have lots of people on the side of the accuser. You know, the compurgators on the side of the accuser that were saying, look, you know, this person accusing you, he wouldn't lie. Well, according to the Your Worth redaction, a prospective judge had to be at least 25 years of age, and his legal knowledge has to be approved by the court justice. We have a quote here. When his teacher sees that he is worthy, let him send him to the court justice, and it is for the court justice to test him. And if he finds him worthy, it is for him to send him to the Lord, and it is for the Lord to grant him justiceship, and it is for him to give 24 pence to the court justice as his fee. So obviously there was tests here to actually become a judge, and you had to have some experience. 25 years of age, that's probably the equivalent of about 40 years of age today, because they had a shorter life expectancy. It was possible to appeal against the judge's decision, and the appellant could demand that the judge show the authority of a book for his judgment. So I guess there's saying there that show me where this law is that you are using to that you're applying to me. The consequences for a judge could be serious if his judgment was reversed, involving a financial penalty equivalent to the value of his tongue as laid down in the value of the parts of the body, and he would also be banned from acting as a judge in future. That's quite a sensible punishment there, based on, you know, as if his tongue had been pulled out, because it was his tongue that had got him into trouble. And quite right. I mean, it should be a very serious punishment here. I'm surprised it's not actually, you know, the death penalty, but he would be banned from acting as a judge again. Truefitz, any thoughts?
Yeah. You know, back then, I meant to say just before that they didn't have, you know, DNA tests and all that. That's why it all had to be gone by witnesses, right? It was really important. They couldn't just do a fingerprint test and see, oh, if you was there or not. So that's what I meant to say with the previous one. And here, you know, you see that you could demand to see what you're being charged with, the law, because law was seen as divine. So you had to, you know, show that this was based on some law or on the Bible, whilst now they just make new laws all the time, right? That the hate speeches are changing all the time, that you can just, what was it? You can just deny that there's only male and female, and that can get you into trouble almost now, that they're constantly changing, that we don't even know the law. Every day it's changing, every year it's drastically different now. And back then you could demand to show me, well, where does this law come from? Well, now you can't. They can just make it up on a whim. And even I believe judges can just, you know, basically pick their own penalties that they're going to give you all the time, right? And it's constantly changing. And you see why it's a lot better to have it how it was back then, that was based on a divine law and not constantly changing on a whim.
Any new laws that were coming in, they had to have a town crier that would go out around the country and he would shout out the fact that there was a new law that was coming in, and then they had to have a certain amount of time before the law actually came into action so that everybody knew what the law was. And of course today there's so many different statutes and laws that they make that people don't know half of them. I mean, you know, the basic ones, the common law, but all there's lots of others that have been introduced. And I guess what you've got here is an early form of habeas corpus. Show me exactly what the law is that you're trying me under. Show me the authority of the book that you are referring to in order to carry out this judgment, or to show whatever it is that you're asking for as proof of that I'm guilty, that sort of thing. Patriarch, any thoughts?
Only on the previous section, where a witness who was proved to have given false testimony with an oath was barred. I think they should have got a more severe punishment, similar to that of the judge. I know there's more responsibility on the judge, but you know, I think there should be more of a punishment for just being barred by the witness, you know, because they could have done a lot of damage.
Good point. Very good point there. You know, they were a false witness. But, you know, you would imagine that there was some other punishment as well for perjury, a serious punishment that's probably just not included there. But they're also saying that meant that you could never stand as a witness again. But yeah, there should be a serious punishment for bearing false witness. Well, we're going to leave that there for this week. And we're going to get into Edmund the First and take us up to Canute the Great in our next episodes. Before we finish, I'll just ask each of you for any final thoughts on Hoeldar and what we've been discussing here. Truthfeeds, any final thoughts on today's episode?
What you just show you, it just shows you how it was very different back then. Today we've got so used to this big government, as I said, just constantly changing the law, and they're kind of seen almost as God that decide everything, right? And you see the danger of that more and more every day, how they're, you know, now they can just take your children off you, and all types of things like that, you know, that things that we never even considered, that people don't realize that when you give over the power, that's what happens. And when you have it back then, where you have juries and judges and witnesses are held accountable, now it's getting more and more lax, where politicians are caught lying all the time and people just don't care anymore, right? And it shows you how the moral values of our civilization are going downhill, and how white civilization used to be back then, right, Sven?
Yeah, also all of these laws, they help to bind the community together and make sure that people are upstanding members of the community. Things which are just missed today. We're just all encouraged to be an individual and not to see ourselves as, you know, the family as the smallest unit of the nation. You know, we're told, oh, anybody can call themselves a member of your nation. You know, instead of it being based on ancestry, it's now based on wherever somebody is born. And we could see in the last episode that just because if you were born somewhere that wasn't your ancestral home, you had to behave yourself for 10 generations before you could be naturalized. And obviously you had to be of the same race before that could happen as well. You know, it's not like you could have people over here from completely different races that could then be naturalized. That wasn't something that could happen. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, overall, it's a really great insight to see the sort of the underlying sort of lawful structures that governed our society through the people and each other, obviously as upheld to a certain extent by higher enforcement, but generally as it's left to the people, I think that's probably the best way and the most in line with nature, isn't it? You know, to have more kind of smaller villages and tribes should take justice into their own hands with a kind of blueprint themselves. And I think it helps to obviously help to just glue people together, to rely on each other more. And, you know, back then, people would have been so close as to kind of trade products with one another rather than getting everything from supermarkets like we do now. There'd be that dependency on each other. It would have been so strong. And that's essentially what binds a nation, isn't it? And, you know, a nation is essentially an extension of, you know, an ethnic group and, you know, who share common genealogy, culture and language. So, yeah, I think, you know, they had a lot of things right back then. And I guess it's portrayed as a more brutal time. But, you know, when we look behind, you know, we look at the roots of how the society functioned, it would have been brutal in the sense of like less technology and more deaths and mortalities like that. But in terms of standard of living and a more wholesome life, it would have been infinitely better than today.
I think it shows you that they were very civilized and all these judgments were tempered by mercy. And I think we can also really see why R.W. Morgan said that the laws of Huelda are by far the greatest literary work of the Dark Ages in Europe. So we can see that they were very, very enlightened. And as I say, that was the laws of the Welsh at this time, but they also reflected the laws of the Anglo-Saxons and the laws of the English. And yet the only difference was the marriage thing, I think. The rest of them were pretty much the same. And that was the laws of Huelda, or Howell the Good. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Truth Fits.
Thanks for having me, as always, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks, Sven.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.